Joining me right now is Merrill Hodge. Merrill, of course, in the NFL for many years back in the 80s and 90s as a running back, primarily with the Steelers. Merrill on ESPN's, you know, litany of NFL shows for years. And in recent years, Merrill Hodge has been a bit of a guru when it comes to evaluating draft prospects, quarterbacks in particular. And actually, that's where I want to start with you. I didn't reach out to you before the draft this year because we didn't need a quarterback for the first time in a while. You were super high on Jaden Daniels last year. You loved everything about him heading into the draft. What did you make of his rookie season?
Well, I thought it was extraordinary. The team played well too. You can't take anything away from, all aspects of the team. Teams win championships. There's no quarterback that's ever won one. There's no running backs ever won one. No defense ever won one. Teams win them. And that's the bottom line, period. Now, your quarterback makes a big difference. I'm not minimizing the role. And I think you guys saw when you have a consistent player there and a guy who's somewhat magical in a lot of ways, he can do a lot to help you and elevate your team. And, he put that on display, he's just more evidence of, the things that translate from college to the NFL and things that you have to really focus in on. And they at least have to show signs of it. Some show it greater than others, but if it isn't on display at some point, then that's where a lot of mistakes are made, because you think, we're making do that, teaching that. When you teach somebody to do anything, that's not the question you should ask. It should be, can it be learned and applied? And Jaden had a lot of study. I've followed him since he was at Arizona State, and his overall development was, I thought, extraordinary. Then he kept getting better and better. I heard somebody say, he had his best year. He had his very best year on his last year. I'm like, well, no kidding. That's what you want. I'm like, that makes no sense. I'm like, but he's obviously the things that he did well, and the skills he developed while he was at LSU really, helped him transition well to the National Football League. I'm happy for Washington, because they've been the amount of skids for a while, as I know So. And I don't think they're going to go anywhere for a while, but they got to keep building. They got still pieces of the team that they got to build on and get better at. You just can't say we're good enough. There's still a lot of areas they got to get better at.
Something you just said is so true. I mean, this time of year, or certainly heading into the draft, you get the people that will say, he had a good senior year, but you got to go back to that freshman year when he was 18 and the year after. That's a reason for concern. No, it's an evolved player.
Ever. That's so really. I mean, well, there's a lot of stuff that's somewhat. I mean, that, to be kind, very questionable, but it happens all the time. I mean, the combine is one of the biggest jokes and embarrassments for a football evaluation for a football player. Now, I'm not saying there's not value in there. I'm seeing the best value is really being able to meet them. Talk to them, interview them, get to know them more, get a sense of their overall knowledge of the game, their awareness, and that there's a great value there. To decide that a guy is going to be a good football player or a bad football player based on a 40-yard dash is the most moronic thing ever done in the history of our game, and I can't even tell you how many people do it. I mean, it just, she was on display this year. I don't know who their analyst is, but there was a receiver that was supposed to be fast. He said he liked him, said he was going to be fast, going to run fast, and he ran a 4.55. Now, I'm not even paraphrasing what he says. He goes, he's not a 4.55 guy. Okay, now wait a minute. He just ran a 4.55 on television. We just saw a 4.55, so how can you say he's not a 4.5 guy? Okay, now, this is what I'm talking about, what he's doing. He's like, well, he's better on tape. He plays, he's faster on that. Okay, but that's the only thing that matters. because that's what he's going to do on Sunday. He's not running in his underwear all by himself with nobody around him. So what you're actually now looking at is something that's irrelevant. So he comes back up. He's like, he won't run a 4-5 again. He's faster than a 4-5. Runs a 4-5 again. And he says he's not a 4-5 guy. Now he's ran it twice. So I'm like, now, how can somebody that's supposed to be an analyst and an expert just deny that we visually saw him run it twice and say he's not that? But now he's not the same player that he was, that he saw on tape. I'm like, okay. I'm just giving this example. Here's what teams do. People do it all the time. This happens every year. They're going downgrading.
Yeah.
They go downgrading. Or let's say he ran a 4-3 and you weren't expecting, but they go upgrading. Now he's better. Well, he's not very good on tape, but now he's better. I'm like, oh my gosh. This is just, it's insane. You know, it's just.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Underwear Olympics.
With your guys.
That is
fascinating.
Yeah, the increase in the obsession over the Indy Combine over the last, I don't know, decade or so is amazing, and it's also incredibly odd to me for a lot of the reasons that you mentioned. You know, I'm curious as to what you think about, like, players that test amazingly well, and then you rely on just looking at the numbers when it comes to production. Like a guy... like Shamar Stewart is an example, who had all the measurables, you know, everything you wanted athletically at the combine, and even the athleticism popped on tape, but somehow he ended up with a sack and a half last year, a sack and a half the year before, and a sack and a half the year before that. So, you know, how do you kind of, you know, square those things?
Does the statistics tell you really nothing? Okay. See, there's no description of how does he play the game. That's what's important. From feet, hips to hands, how does he play the game? Like, I'll give you guys a great example. Or it wasn't even a debate, actually. It was when Khalil Mack and Jadeveon Clowney came out. When you looked at them on tape, from a football skill set, from feet, hips to hands, who could play inside linebacker, outside linebacker, defensive end, you name it, there was one guy. And his skill set, probably the best I've ever seen, actually, in 25 years of doing this, was Khalil Mack. Like, it wasn't even close. Now, what did Jadeveon Clowney do? Now, feet, hips to hands with Jadeveon Clowney, not very good. His motor, awful. His overall IQ, awful. A third of the time, he's going to do something for your team. Okay, well, a third of the time ain't going to work, okay? Khalil Mack's going to do something 100% of the time for your team. And I go back to that, those two guys coming out. If the Texans had drafted Khalil Mack, you know J.J. Watt in his prime, you might have had the two most movable, wreckable pieces
together.
In maybe football history
together.
That you could have dominated defensively in schemes and things. But there's another great example. Well, Jadeveon Clowney had some physical measurements that were somewhat freakish. That doesn't tell me. You just told me stuff about. You didn't tell me anything about playing football. Is what you didn't tell me. Is what I'm getting at.
Sure.
Only tape could tell you can they play football.
Did you spend as much time this year on the quarterbacks as you did last year?
Yeah, probably more so, because there are just so many of them, and there was really no. I mean, there's really no first round talent. There was. Like, if you use the standard of a first-round talent, which, listen, if I'm building a team, the last thing I'll ever do is I'm gonna lower the standard and draft, especially that position, draft a quarterback, just because there's not a guy who's the first. Well, hey, this is all we got this year. Well, they don't draft one. Unless you're so loaded on your team, that's all you need. Which most teams that need a quarterback, it's not the last thing they need. And there's very few teams that are just like, well, we're just missing a quarterback. Joe Burrow, Jaden Daniels, and C.J. Stroud. Okay, there's your criteria. Okay, Joe Burrow takes him to a Super Bowl in a couple of years. C.J. Stroud, and now the Texans are the real deal. Threw for more yards than any rookie in the history of our game. And then Jaden Daniels wants to step away from the Super Bowl. From what were you guys? Win three games a year before?
Yeah, four.
Whatever it was?
Four, yeah.
Okay, well, four. I mean, And there was a team turnaround, but his play was significant. Okay, can't deny that. That position, how he played it, was extraordinary. Okay, there's not a quarterback. Actually, there's one guy I actually felt had a true NFL skill set that would be first round talent. His injuries and his age, you know, people were a little scared of that. It was the kid from Louisville.
Tyler Shook.
Tyler was that guy. He was actually one of the last guys. Actually, I had watched him on television when they played Miami, actually.
Yeah.
Because I wanted to watch this Cam kid. I just watched him on television. It was early in the college season. And I'm like, man, you know what? I'm just an overall sense of how the game is going to be played at the next level. I was like, man, why did that Louisville kid just seem to be a lot better than the Miami kid? You know, because that's the first time I'd ever seen him. I was like, I would not. He bothered me from a lot of aspects. Guy, he doesn't play in structure. His feet are sloppy. He's never in a true position to throw the football, so he's reckless.
Are you talking about Cam Ward now?
Cam Ward. And I'm like, boy, that's a big project there. You know, I'm just watching this, but I'm like, I can't make a full evaluation if they watch on tape, but it was structure-wise, it didn't look good. Okay, it was not a lot of the type of structure that you're looking for to make it an easy transition to NFL. There's a lot of things that you've got to fix, change, and work on before you've got a chance there. Anyway, and the Louisville kid, I was like, gosh dang. I'm like, that guy was about, I was like, holy cow. But I'm just watching him. The kid in Louisville is better than the kid in Miami. I don't know anything about the kid in Louisville either. I don't know. Especially when I see the kid in Miami. And that's from a game TV perspective, which don't ever take that as your evidence, because it can lie to you. And I say TV lies and highlights really lie. And so I was like, but just from an overall structure and how they played and rhythm and stuff, I was like, well, Louisville kid was better. But now I want to watch the tape. He's about 25th on my depth chart, and I come across him. It's the first game. I was like, holy cow. Like, this kid had the best real skills. He looked the best. He threw the ball the best. He played it. So he played in an environment that's going to, when you think about what's going to happen in the NFL, okay, you don't have the 4 or 5 seconds that these guys have. The Miami Cam Ward has 4 or 5 seconds, you know. He had a great offensive line. That's gone. Those days are over. You have 2.5 at the best. Right. You better get rid of the football. You're going to have to play with people in your face, and it's going to be a cloudy, dirty pocket. Can you function in that arena? This kid, Louisville, was extraordinary. And his accuracy was not completion accuracy. He has different levels of accuracy. When a guy completes the ball, that's not accurate. You completed it. You really have to break down, like, every pass. Like, is there a run after the catch? Is the ball where only the receiver could get it and was that the throw that needed to be made? There's a whole host of things you have to walk through and evaluate. Is he really accurate? Okay, that guy's really accurate. And he's got a big arm that adds to that. And I notice I didn't say that, number one, because it's really not, it's not the biggest deal. I mean, that's just an added value to your accuracy. He's 6'5", very mobile, plays well, processes things quickly. And this is just a bunch of stuff. And I was like, wow, and he was my number one quarterback. That was,
okay.
If I was in a position where I had to do it, I would have taken that kid as number one. So Saints, to me, they locked out based on what happened to them. You know, I don't know if they saw all this coming, you know, Derek Carr retiring or having to retire. And being in that position, you know, Taysom Hill is coming off a bad knee, and, you know, where will he be? I think they got the steal of the draft. They got him in the second round. I know it was early in the second round, but he was clearly warranted a first round from how I viewed him. And if I stack him up against those three I just mentioned, there's a lot of similarities that I could draw that are very similar to those guys that we just talked about.
Yeah, the three on your, you know, recent, the best in terms of what, yeah, you know, how you've analyzed them, Joe Burrow, C.J. Stroud, and Jaden Daniels. So the, you know, the story of the draft over 3 days was Shedeur Sanders. What did you think of him?
Well, this gets misunderstood when I say it. He's a good quarterback. And I mean, he's a good quarterback. There's a lot of things he does well. There wasn't anything extraordinary that you would be like, Borky, that's going to be scary. You know, that's dangerous. When you peel him apart, though, you know, first of all, if he was really elite, okay, you wouldn't be making excuses for the system that we run and blaming your offensive line. But the other thing is their offensive line, okay? And then they say, well, he held the ball, because he does hold the ball a long time. If your offensive line is so bad, you won't have time to hold the ball.
Yeah.
So maybe the offensive line wasn't as bad. That was, I watched all his tape. Okay, so their line and the people that they matched up against, his offensive line was not a bad offensive line. They're acting like, yeah, he had no protection. He had nothing. And that is absolutely 100% incorrect. The bubble screens that they ran, and, you know, they attribute that to the offensive line. I'm like, okay, nah. Man, I've watched and played and studied and taught and coached. So I know if your quarterback's really good, man, he actually offsets the issues with your offensive line.
Right.
Okay? You don't have to create excuses for them because your quarterback hides them. When he's a good processor, he's accurate, he gets rid of the football. So going to the, you know, you start peeling it apart. There's a reason he holds the ball. And his processing is not really precise and sharp. Okay, well, in college, if that's a struggle, you're going to times that by 10 coming to the National Football League. And you're going to be limited in what you can do, in how you're going to be able to install things you're going to be able to execute and run. And that's going to be a limitation, you know. And his athleticism, you know, you come from Deion Sanders, you think, oh, he's some dynamic athlete. And he's really not. He's
like, yeah, right.
He doesn't have a lot of fast twitch to him. He's slow twitch. But he has mobility, you know. But it's just good. Like, in the NFL, they'll go, okay, well, our defensive ends can run him down. Our tackles, we're okay if our defense line. So I'm just saying how they'll look him in the NFL. They're not going to go, oh my gosh. I mean, like, you can't sleep all week. It's like, who are you going to spy him with?
Right.
You know, this is not Lamar Jackson. They're like, God, who we got? Or we got to play so disciplined, we can't let him out the gate. We have to push him and push him. I mean, this extraordinary discipline. You know, you try to play with that discipline all the time, but now we have to play with the pristine discipline because he'll kill us. You know, there's none of that. You know, you won't go, oh my gosh, you know, he's just really good. He's just good. So I see why he's not drafted in the first round. And quite honestly, that's the best for the kid. Okay, we just talked about three guys, all they have done over the last 6 years, okay?
Right.
Let's say he went in the first round. What are they going to expect? And he's Deion Sanders' son. So that's going to add another layer of expectation. I don't care where he goes. Here's what's going to be expected. We're going to be in the playoffs. He's going to throw for more yards than C.J. Stroud. He's going to be just like those guys. And he doesn't have the skill set to do that. So then what happens? Oh, he's a bust. You know, I'm here. So he's in a much better scenario to really flourish and play in this league than if he'd went in the first round.
What round do you think he should have gone in? What round do you think he should have gone in?
Oh, I had him in a second and third round category. But I understand why he fell even further. You've got to consider what he's bringing to the table, how you're going to manage that, who he's coached him his entire life, okay? How he's going to handle different coaching. I did this with my son. My son was one of the best quarterbacks in the state of Kentucky here. He and I went to play quarterback at BYU. I mean, he was just a phenomenal athlete, quarterback. I mean, he was a phenomenal quarterback. And I coached him from age 7, I mean, all the way up to when he got to high school, and I was like, okay, this guy's time for me to just cut the cord. You know, he needs new coaching. You know, so if I'd have carried him into high school and into college, you know, I think that I would even be like, oof, you know, this might be a little different for Bo, you know, going into it. You know, so he's never experienced that, and I know people were very, very concerned about that. That's not a major, major concern, but you're crazy if you don't talk about it. You know, then... You know, I was at the combine. I saw a lot of things where he was just very disrespectful to for time. You know, teams have 10 minutes, and he's taking calls for his dad, from his dad, burning 5 minutes of the 10 minutes the team has. And it's just like, if you're going to do that,
yeah,
and you're already going to disrespect people, and, you know, you wouldn't sit him down and go, wow, you would not be blown away with his football IQ. You would not be blown away. You'd be like, whoa. So all of those things start to add up. So then you look at, okay, what is he for us? Is he going to be a backup? Well, geez, I mean, we need something. That's what I'm talking about, second or third or fourth round pick, okay. Do I want to pick somebody that's not going to even play?
Yeah, well,
in
that's
the second, third, or fourth round.
You nailed it.
I got to get somebody that can help my team. And yeah, people forget it. I go back to what I said in the beginning. Teams win championships. That's what you better be building on. You got a luxury item to get a guy like, you know, him as a backup. So use it in the later rounds. So now, how Cleveland went about it, that is still just when I was about to give them credit for, like, I think they finally straightened out their quarterback woes and make a mistake. Boy, they just they come right back and took the lead. I'm like, what the heck were you doing? You just drafted the kid
from
Oregon.
Yeah.
Who actually, that the kid from Oregon is really good.
Yeah.
That kid was like 6'2", 6'3". Oh, my gosh.
Exactly.
He very well could have been.
He processes quickly, doesn't he?
I'm telling you what, he's everything. Because I've interviewed him at the combine, and you know, he actually, you know, he spun it on me and asked me a question. And you know, he was like, "Well, if I was 6'3", what I'd be?" He goes, "Well, if I was 6'3", I'd go, "You're a first rounder."
Yeah,
I go, "That's just the fact." I go, "Listen, 5'10" in our league is a massive handicap. Okay, there's only one guy. I think Drew Brees. Drew Brees is 6 foot, though. I mean, Russell Wilson's 5'10", so Russell Wilson's won a Super Bowl. I go, he didn't win one either. Fran Tarkenton
did not win it. No, he didn't win it, yeah.
I know of no other quarterback. I don't know the entire history. Anybody that's 5'10", that's won a Super Bowl, I mean, below 6 foot, other than Russell Wilson. And he had best running game in football and the best defense in football. Okay, and he was a great compliment. And as long as he was in that role, I mean, the Steelers saw that. Everybody saw that. That's why Seattle moved on from him. He's a great compliment as long as you have those things in place. He's not going to carry you. He's not going to have set deficiencies if you don't. These other three guys I talked about, Burrow, CJ Stroud, James Adams, they can offset some deficiencies. Okay, like a guy like DeShaun Sanders cannot offset deficiencies.
Yeah.
So he's where actually would ideally would be, I think, sets him up the very best to have a really good NFL career if he gets a chance to play, you know, and he gets a chance, you know, in a role, and they can build a team around him and they have time. But he's just not special. There's nothing that you would say, wow, this is really elite. He just didn't have any of that. So I completely understand that. The reason he started to fall like he did is because then those other things started to play a role in teams.
Yeah, of course. You know, is the juice worth the squeeze if you're going to end up with, you know, a backup quarterback and everything that comes with it? That's why some of the, you know, perceived headaches that were super talented got picked, because they knew they were going to play. Look at what we're reading in the last 2 days about Caleb Williams and his father and what they were trying to do. But where did he go? He went number one overall because of the talent. I'm curious, did you have any opinion about Washington's draft?
No. I'm telling you, I don't even know who they drafted. I guess as you said that, I'm like, I don't know who you guys drafted in the first round.
We drafted, Washington drafted a tackle, Josh Connerly from Oregon, in the first round.
Yeah. I was so tunnel vision on quarterbacks here and running backs that it's probably the first time in 25 years that I've only done that.
Okay, let's talk about running backs. Was Genty worth the number 6 pick in the draft?
Yes.
Really?
Yes. He has extraordinary, you know, now listen, I know a little more about him maybe than most. Dirk Cutter, who was,
right,
man, if you remember, he was head coach of Tampa Bay.
Sure.
Before Bruce Arians came in. He was office coordinator in Atlanta for decades, forever. And is one of the greatest minds in I have ever met in football, and I play with some of the greatest: Chuck Noll, Bill Cowell. I've worked with Bill Parcells, Bill Polians,
yep.
Tony Dungy's, Marty Shine. He was my high school coach. Dirk Cutter was my high school coach. I've known Dirk Cutter since I was in high school, and Dirk Cutter is the offensive coordinator up at Boise State. You know, in this, for the last couple of years, so I just had a chance to talk to him. You know, to get some true insights about him as a kid, and he's supposedly just as pure a human being as you could possibly get. Like, you're not going to go to bed at night worried about him. Now, I know I'm not talking about his football skills yet, you know, but that is important when you're going to invest in a runner at that point. Now look at his skill set, and that makes him extraordinary. He has an extraordinary power and balance and agility to him that is truly unique. I mean, in his style, the way he runs, and he's, you know, he's not a big target either. And to try to tackle him, I can't tell you, I've seen every scenario he does such a good job of using the things they issue for protection, and that is shoulder pads. So they give you those because they want you to use them. You know, those are your weapons. It's not your helmet. And he does such a good job of making it tough on you to fight to his legs, because you got to fight through his shoulders. And he has such great balance, and that when you hit him, he is able to rebalance himself and move laterally and vertically, whatever is required after the hit. And he has home run speed. Like, you blink, I mean, you know, he gets the edge, he's done. And that's just a rare combination. So I'll give you this. Everybody's like, well, the Penn State game really showed who he was. You're right, he did. That's exactly his best game. His best game.
I agree.
Guess what? That is exactly what you wanted to see.
Toughest 104 yards of the season.
That is exactly what he's going to see on Sunday.
Yeah.
I mean, they devoted everything to stop that kid. Okay, and he got 104 yards. Okay, I'm telling you this. If you devote that type to some other type of runners, you might get 50. Okay, but that was that, but how he ran. Okay, so I already talked about quarterbacks and just those two things that are so important. You build from there. If they don't have those two things, processing and accuracy, and there's different degrees there, then we got a problem. If you're lacking one of them, we got a problem. And the chances are significantly high you will not succeed in this league. In this league, from a runner perspective, I don't think a lot of people know this, that the college field is different than the NFL field.
Hashes.
The hash marks are different in the NFL. So, and the reason for that, the hash marks in college are wider. In the NFL, they're narrow. That means you have to play in the middle. So the most important aspect for a runner is, if I played that position, I learned it well, I understand it well, I know it intimately, is your ability to start, stop, and redirect and run with power and get yards when there's a crack. Is how you have to learn how to run in the NFL. If they have provided me a crack, you know, or a yard, I got to get that 2 yards. I got to get that 3 yards. I got to add a yard or two to whatever they've got me, and I've got to learn to run like that, because that is the dirt you're going to face. That's the trash you're going to. That's the variety of way you're going to run in our league. Versus college, where you can run to the perimeter. You know, my guy runs a 4.4, you run a 4.6, I outrun you. You know, that's why they play on the perimeter so much in college, because you can, because those hash marks make a difference for that, you know, and it makes a difference in the running game, too. And most of the guys, my guys are better than your guys. That's college football, a big portion. In the NFL, my guy is as good as your guy. Hash marks are in the middle, we play in the middle. And who can play in the middle? And this kid can play in the middle.
He loves Ashton Gentry. Washington gets Ashton Gentry in week 3 of the NFL season, with a little rest coming off a week 2 Thursday night game. I enjoyed that with Merrill Hodge. There was a lot more. You can catch the rest of it on my podcast if you want. He's really good talking about football. Frankie Louvu wants something banned in the NFL. I'll tell you what it is when we come back. Kevin Sheehan Show, the Team 980, theteam980.com. We're free and live on the Odyssey app. So yesterday, Frankie Louvu, Washington's very good linebacker, was on Good Morning Football, the NFL Network show. And he was asked what he thought of the tush-push rule, which will be debated and more likely than not voted on tomorrow at the league meetings in Minneapolis. It's not going to get voted on today. It will get voted on tomorrow. We'll talk about that here in a moment. But this is what Frankie Louvu said when he was asked about what should be done with the tush-push.
You are, in a way, linked to this play because of that moment. You also have a powerful voice. This week, in a matter of a couple of days, the league is going to vote on the tush-push, whether to keep it or to ban it. As a guy who has been out there in a playoff game trying to defend it, is it unfair, and should the league ban it?
Man, my personal opinion?
Yeah.
I think they should ban it, you know what I mean? But I know the argument is going to be about, like, hey, yo, well, you guys have to stop it. Don't get us in short yardage and whatnot. But, yeah. I mean, it's kind of like a Chico play, man. You got Jordan Mailata on the right. You got, you know, it's pretty much a scrum in rugby. That's how I kind of look at it. And we got to have a scrum, too, on the other side. And the scrum is, you know, we have a cadence where we all go at once. It's not like you hard count or and this and that where, you know, now you're getting us or myself jumping over the pile thinking that they're about to snap the ball. And that's just my own personal opinion, and I'm going to leave it at that.
Really interesting answer from him. It's probably not the answer that Dan Quinn wanted to hear, because Dan Quinn, remember, was asked about it a few months ago, and he just gave what I thought was the right answer, which is we're just preparing to try to be better at stopping it. You know, you don't want to get into this potential bulletin board material thing where the Eagles, you know, and now their in-division rival are trying to get the play banned. You know, let the rest of the league fight that. You kind of sit back and just let it play out without saying much. I mean, I don't have a problem really with what Frankie Louvu said. I actually agree with him. I've said this many times in the past. I don't like the play. I don't like the play because I think it is a play that comes with incredibly inherent issues. I mean, the play has not been officiated well at all. There are neutral zone infractions. There are false starts. There are lining up off sides offensively. When we get into this formation and you know the tush push is coming, you know, the replays of this play, you know, 50% of the time produce clear-cut evidence that there was either a penalty offensively or a penalty defensively that wasn't called, or both on the same play and wasn't called. Secondly, I do agree that it looks like a non-football play. It looks very rugby scrum-like, you know, looks very Old Glory-like. You can catch Old Glory. Really good team here locally. I just I don't like the play. I also, like, if I were a Philly fan, on one level, I'd be really interested to know how many yards we're actually giving up by running the play. I've talked about this, you know, recently, but third and short, fourth and short, you know, especially in the middle of the field, you know, not necessarily in goal to go. I mean, that's when you typically see the biggest explosive runs. Everybody within, you know, a couple of yards of the line of scrimmage. And Saquon Barkley, with that offensive line, with, by the way, also the quarterback is a run threat. I bet you that the Eagles are giving up a lot of yardage by running the tush push. Now, the flip side to that argument would be, yeah, but we maintain possession of the football, and it's more than worth it to give up some of the big play potential for the one time that you're going to get stopped on a handoff to Saquon Barkley and end up having to punt because the tush push has such a high success rate. It's actually, you know, a success rate like in the 80 percentile range over the last few years. I don't like the play. I've wanted it to be banned. So, look, we had Mark Maskey on the show yesterday. Maskey really covers this stuff well for the Post. He's in Minneapolis for the league meetings. He just wrote a little while ago, and a lot of what he wrote was some of the stuff he said to us. Like, the three big topics over the next 2 days at league meetings are this: can NFL players participate in the Olympics in the flag football competition in 2028? I'll be honest with you. I don't have much interest in that topic one way or the other. That's down the road. And if they end up being able to participate, great. It's, you know, are they potentially going to get injured? Okay. The league will decide on the merits of that. They're not going to miss any football by participating in the Olympics. The Olympics in 4 years in LA are in, you know, late July, like the last 2 weeks of July. So maybe they missed the first 2 days of camp. I don't really care about that issue. The two issues that are going to be discussed and potentially voted on tomorrow are tush push and playoff format seating. The playoff format seating question proposed by the Lions is seeding based on record. I'm in favor of that. Maskey pretty much told us yesterday he does not think that that will pass. He does not think it's got 24 votes, but he does think that that's something that may get passed when they go to an 18-game schedule. I think it makes sense for so many reasons. Number one is it's just fair. Number two is it doesn't ruin the division integrity or the division emphasis, because to win a division still means an automatic spot in the postseason. And then three, you're going to increase the number of games at the end of the season that have meaning, because you're playing for seeding in addition to playing for the playoff games. What does that mean? That typically means even more revenue for the league down the road. I like that idea. You know, I was somebody put this out, not that we couldn't have done this on our own, but if you just take the last 4 years of playoffs, in 2021, the seeding would not have been impacted at all. It laid out with the top four records were all four division winners. In 2022, there would have been one change. Remember that Chargers-Jags game in Jacksonville, where Jacksonville came back from like a 27-0 deficit and won that playoff game? They would have actually been on the road against the Chargers. And in that same year, Dallas, who went to Tampa and beat the Buccaneers, would have been hosting as a 4 seed against the Giants, who would have been a 5 seed. So it would have been different matchups altogether in the NFC. In 2023, each conference had one difference. It would have been in the AFC, the Browns hosting the Dolphins instead of playing on the road against the Texans. The Texans ended up hosting the Browns and winning a first-round playoff game. The Texans instead would have been playing at Kansas City. Big difference, because they were a game worse than the Browns. In the NFC that year, if you remember, the Eagles were tanking at the end of the year. They went on the road and got blown out against the Bucs. Well, they would have actually hosted a game against the Rams instead. And then last year, we know there would have been many different changes in the NFC. In the AFC, the Chargers and Texans would have flip-flopped on where that game was played. The Chargers ended up losing to the Texans in Houston. If it were seeded based on record, they would have hosted the game against Houston. And in the NFC, man, the whole playoffs would have been, first round would have been different. The Lions still would have been the 1 seed, but the Eagles would have been the 2, Vikings 3, Washington 4, Green Bay 5, Bucks 6, Rams 7. So Washington would have hosted a first round game against Green Bay instead of playing on the road against Tampa. The Vikings would have hosted a game against the Bucks instead of traveling to face the Rams. They ended up playing that game in Arizona because of the wildfires. And the Eagles would have, instead of hosting the Packers, would have hosted the Rams in the first round. They ended up hosting the Rams in the second round of the postseason. I just think that there's so much that makes sense about that, and I don't think you ruin the emphasis on the division. Remember this about the NFL schedule. Right now, only 6 of the 17 games are division games. Now, they're important games, but the other 11 are even more important because you could go 6-0 in the division. If you go 2-9 in the non-division games, you're not going to the postseason. Now, we understand that typically a 6-0 division record means you've got a really good chance to make the playoffs as a division winner. But when we go to an 18-game schedule, it will literally be a third of the games. It'll be 6 division games, 12 non-division games, unless that extra game ends up being maybe a third division matchup. Imagine that, by the way, just for a moment. Bear with me. What if when they went to 18 games, instead of just adding another non-division game and making it 12 non-division games, 6 division games, what if instead you played 9 division games? You played each of your 3 division opponents 3 times during the season. And then the other half of the schedule would be against, you know, a division in your conference. That would be another 4 games. A division in the other conference, that would be 8. And then you get a 9th game, you know, against an NFC opponent in a division where they finished in the same spot that you did. Can you imagine? Just I think I've like pitched this once before several years ago. What if you played 3 times each year against the Cowboys, Eagles, and Giants? You had 9 division games, and you just rotated in terms of, you know, one year you're going to play the Cowboys twice at home, once on the road. The next year you're going to play them once at home, twice on the road, etc. That would put a lot more emphasis on division play. The rivalries would be even more often, you know, battled out on the field. Anybody with me on that? I think that would be really actually, would it be excessive? Because when you get to 18 games, the division games, if you only play your division opponents twice, it's going to make up a third of your schedule. That's it. A third. The other 2/3 are going to be non-division games. If you went to facing your division opponents 3 times a year instead of twice a year, now it's half your schedule. You like that idea, Max?
Yeah. Real hate would be in full effect. It would be awesome. I kind of, because Commanders and Eagles fans have talked plenty this offseason. It would be nice to see them third, maybe even if you get to the playoffs, a 4th time. Because how many times have you seen teams play each other? 4 times, not 3.
Other than the NBA, NHL, and Major League Baseball, no other sport has. I mean, those sports you're playing division rivals. You know, I think up until recently in Major League Baseball, weren't you playing 19 games against your division opponents? And then I think they reduced that number recently.
It's something like that.
See, the problem with the NBA and even the NHL to a certain degree is that fans don't even know what the divisions are. In the NBA in particular.
Yeah.
Nobody can name right now the divisions and the teams in them. It's basically always a conference deal. And the NBA never was a big deal division-wise. It just wasn't. I think hockey had more emphasis on the divisions, especially back in the day when they were like named, you know.
Yeah,
Patrick,
for sure, back in the day.
You know, the Adams, the Norris. But I think this was not the intended conversation. But because I want to get back to the tush push here. But I think it would be, we're probably 2 to 3 years away, maybe 2, from the 18-game schedule. Maskey suggested that, you know, the new TV deal would happen in 2030, and they'll probably try to get to that 18-game schedule at least 2 years, maybe 3 in advance. So, you know, adding that extra game, it'll be interesting to see if anybody even proposes what I just proposed. I bet you don't even see the league even consider that. I think it should be considered. I think it definitely should be considered. You'd also, by the way, theoretically, not that all the divisions, you know, are perfect when it comes to geographic proximity to one another. Obviously, in the NFC East, you've got, you know, you got the Cowboys, you know, with Washington, Philadelphia, and New York so close. And there are other kind of examples. But for the most part, you know, you probably cut down significantly on travel. You definitely would cut down on travel, you know, because you would be playing Washington, New York, and Philly would be playing, you know, extra games against each other. Same with Buffalo, the Jets, and the Patriots. Same with the Ravens, Steelers, Browns, and Bengals. You know, Detroit, Minnesota, Green Bay, Chicago, Tampa, Atlanta, Carolina, New Orleans. I mean, you get out west, the travel's further for the Rams to, you know, or for Arizona to go play Seattle, or for, you know, KC to go to LA. But you'd cut down significantly on travel. I don't know. I have a feeling a lot of people would be like, nah, it's too much. The tradition is twice a year, your place and ours. Let's keep it that way. But the tradition could become, yeah, it's twice at our place, once at yours, and then next year it's twice at yours. It might actually, on some levels, I'm thinking it through, diminish the excitement level of the division games if you're playing an extra three per year. It's not what I intended to talk about. I do want to get into the tush push and find out what you think. It's going to get voted on tomorrow. I'll explain the Packers' proposal, which changes it from just eliminating the tush push to something much more in depth in terms of how the rule would actually get officiated. I'll explain when we come back.